All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have got a packed show for you today, so it's not going to be no time for fooling around, all right? At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with David Palumbo Liu, who's a professor of comparative literature at Stanford University and who has been targeted by the fascist newspaper, the Stanford Review, and called a terrorist for being a member of the campus anti-fascist network. Before that, we'll be listening to an excerpt of a talk from Bob Avakian about the Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. Better world is possible. And this is part of the Q&A section of that, and I'll talk more about that when we get to that place. Opening the show up, though, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show. It's been way too long. His name is Sam Menefee-Leiby, and he's from the Dead City Legal Posse. And we're talking about in Washington, D.C., which is also, some might say a dead city, but that would be insulting all the normal people that live there. But it's basically, we're going to be talking with Sam about the latest developments in the important fight to defend the Inauguration Day J20 protesters. The arrest and charges against more than 200 people demonstrating against Trump's inauguration, this whole big, huge fascist celebration, standing up and saying, no, we're not going to allow this to go unspoken to, or we're not going to allow it to go like it was just normal things, all right? And it was a major escalation. The attack on them was a major escalation of political repression. The next trial is slated to begin on April 17th. Sam, welcome back to the show, man.
Thanks for having me back, Michael. It's great to be on.
Yeah, it's good to talk with you again, man. We're going to jump into this because I don't want to waste a minute. We're going to have to really, I want to get as much as we can. And actually, we have another person who's going to be joining us, and her name is Anya. Is that your name?
Yes. Hi, Anya.
Hi. How are you?
It's great to be on. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, we'll be getting back to you in just a couple minutes. I want to start out with a few things with Sam first, though. All right?
Yeah, great.
Okay. All right, Sam, it's been a while since we last spoke, so let's kind of catch up. The big news is that late last December, the first group of defendants were found innocent of all charges. And the thing is that this was the opening salvo in the Trump regime's attack on the J20 defendants, and it was a warning to anyone who would stand up against Trump. Let's talk about what actually has happened since we last spoke.
Yes, as you mentioned earlier, as a part of the many autonomous protests against the inauguration of Donald Trump last January 20th, 2017. There was an anti-fascist, anti-capitalist march that was brutally attacked by the Metropolitan Police Department. Over 230 people were kettled and mass arrested. About 214 of those people wound up facing 8 felony charges for most of last year. The first 6 went to trial in November and December on what wound up being 6 felony charges and 2 misdemeanors. They were acquitted of all charges. By the time they got to trial, there were 194 people left. A couple of people had taken pleas. A couple of other people had charges dropped. And then on January 18th, 2018, of the remaining 188 defendants, 129 had their charges dropped, with the U.S. Attorney in Washington, D.C., Assistant U.S. Attorney Jennifer Kirchhoff, stating her intention to proceed on prosecuting 59 of the remaining defendants on all of the original 8 charges. So there was no amendment to the actual indictment itself, but charges were dismissed without prejudice against 129 defendants, including Anya. So it's been a very exciting, couple months here. The next trial starts April 17th, and it's 5 members actually of the Industrial Workers of the World and the General Defense Committee who are being tried for allegedly organizing the march. And it's really sort of stark to look at the statement of evidence against them from the U.S. Attorney's Office, and it's basically criminalizing them for organizing a protest.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you talked about the idea that this, around what's happened with the dismissal of these charges for these other people, the way that that's done, actually, it also implies that it doesn't really say, okay, they're not guilty. It says, actually, we decided not to prosecute, but it's at this time. So things could be brought back against them in the future, right?
That's right. Yeah, that can be brought back at any time before the statute of limitations is up. And my understanding is that the statute of limitations is 5 years.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, one of the things that actually I think it's important for people to understand is that while there was an element of the Trump fascist machine seeking revenge for the J20 demonstration, which did shine a light on the character of the regime and the need to fight it, but there was also, in relation to this whole trial, there was also more ominous implications in terms of fascist repression. They really seem to be approaching this, not just to get their, pound of flesh off of the people that demonstrated, but actually there's a lot going on in terms of what they're bringing into place, what they're trying to cement into place in terms of the rise of fascism. Is that true?
Yeah, so we learned all sorts of really disturbing things about the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C., openly collaborating with far-right organizations like Project Veritas, the Media Research Center, the militia group, the Oath Keepers, and a number of other sources, while also admitting in open court that they have an entire protocol for basically doing undercover infiltration of what they call anti-establishment groups. When asked to describe what anti-establishment groups are, they said anti-establishment groups are groups that have concerns about things like racial equality and fighting for the environment and against climate change and fighting against fascism. So they seem to think that is against their, a threat to their power, and they seem to have no compunction with collaborating with, openly dishonest and sort of proto-fascistic organizations like Project Veritas and the Oath Keepers.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to ask you one more question before I move on to Anya for a minute. In the wake of the loss for the rulers in the first trial, the Trump fascist machine and regime has not backed off but has fine-tuned their assault, it seems to me, whittling down a number of defendants and sharpening their assault. One person is being charged even though he wasn't at the march, but he went to an organizing meeting. Let's talk about this, because I think actually there's this point of, it's not just, again, as I was saying earlier, it's not just the point of that there's these fascistic things going on, but it's actually part and parcel of setting up a whole sort of structure and reinforcing a fascist approach to all this. I mean, people were considered guilty. They were charged with being guilty for things that you would never expect, like you were in the area. You did this, you did that. And there's all these things that have been charged with people. People have been charged with, which involved actually even doing things like, they wore black, or they marched in solidarity with people. All these kinds of things that people think back and remember the good old days when that was just like going to a demonstration. But now it's actually considered treason almost.
Yeah, I mean, so they're trying to define very explicitly sort of overt acts as indications of conspiracy to riot. And those overt acts include things like chanting whose streets are streets, wearing black, showing up to an anti-fascist, anti-capitalist march. They are very explicitly trying to criminalize standard protest activity and make it punishable by these felony offenses that carried potentially decades in prison.
Mm-hmm. And just to be clear, again, basically, these new prosecutorial tools that are being forged it does come down to, as you're saying, if you are at a demonstration, you're guilty of whatever happens there. And this is part of forging a whole new sort of way of operating in court in relation to all this.
Yeah. I mean, they really are trying to sort of bring in an ethos of collective guilt into the criminal justice system. And, I don't think any of us were particularly fond of the U.S. criminal justice system before all this happened, but this would be a notable departure.
Mm-hmm. Anya, welcome to the show. I didn't get a chance to say that earlier, but welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Sure. Now, you were involved in, why don't you tell us your story? What happened to you?
I was in D.C. on Inauguration Day as a street medic in training with a group called Food Not Bombs, where I live in Newark. So we were just there, just to protest fascism and anti-capitalism, basically.
That's a pretty significant thing to be doing. what happened to you? Because you got arrested, and what happened? How did you get arrested, and what happened?
Well, at first we were just there to be there and to protest anti-fascism, and almost immediately we noticed the presence of a large amount of riot cops with militarized weapons. And they moved in pretty fast. There was a minimal amount of property damage from what I noticed. And I think we were kettled about 230 of us in total. 230 people, including journalists, medics in training, legal servers, lawyers, and innocent bystanders. We were just brutalized and then kettled on the street corner for 9 hours.
So you went in and then you were charged. And then what's happened since then?
Then we've had a couple of court dates, and most of our charges have been dropped. There's 59 people remaining that we're standing in solidarity with, but 129 defendants, our charges were dropped. And I think it was a result of our collective hard work and solidarity and signing on to the points of unity that the defendants wrote up together.
Well, one of the things I think is really important is when you look at this and the idea that basically, people, and including the fact that, when I was reading up on this over the last couple of days, one of the things that really struck me is that what's being established by this, if there isn't a fight that can turn it back, can defeat it, one of the things that's being established by this, and I think, Sam, probably it'd be good for you to speak to this, and it's one of the things that's being established is that there are all kinds of changes in the laws right now that are being brought in that actually allow them to do things. That, I mean, even the idea that, you know, the judge is an activist judge. I mean, when people were talking about the idea that there would be that it just walking down the street. I mean, and the judge is actually looking for ways to figure out, okay, you aren't just walking down the street. If you were wearing black and you were in the street, you're a criminal. You deserve to, you're guilty. You deserve to be charged. There's a lot that kind of stuff that's going on that I think is really important for people to understand that this is sort of the character of what's happening. If you dare to go to a demonstration, or if you dare to be in a neighborhood, or if you dare to wear black in close proximity to a demonstration, you are considered a threat to national security, basically.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things that came out during the first trial is there have been general challenges from defense counsel all along for all of the defendants, that basically the police did not have probable cause to effect a mass arrest. That, you know, the sort of standards of probable cause in the United States have long been that you need sort of individualized suspicion of a particular person to have committed a particular criminalized act in order to effect an arrest. And that here they arrested an entire group of people without any indication that the cops had any sort of had distinguished any individuals or that they were sort of discriminating at all about who they were rounding up, while also, you know, subjecting them to a tremendous amount of brutality. The judge basically established legal grounds for collective probable cause, which is not something that is supposed to exist in the U.S. criminal justice system. So there are particular things that are sort of outlining and laying the groundwork for the capacity to prosecute people collectively, to prosecute people for behavior that wasn't previously deemed sort of criminalized activity, and to sort of, you know, weaponize already existing laws and make harsher new laws to effectively criminalize left protest, right? Because we also got to remember that the anti-fascist protesters were attacked like this, but when, you know, the fascists openly making sort of genocidal chants rally, that they rarely get attacked by the police.
Mm-hmm. In fact, actually, what's become clear in a lot of this, I think one of the scandals that's sort of emerging around this is the role of the police in relation to the fascists, which is pretty damn sympathetic and actually, in a lot of ways, part and parcel of it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at its heart, fascism is about an authoritarian eliminationist ethos. And at its heart, policing is about an authoritarian ethos that is about geographically relocating and incarcerating, you know, who the people that they deem to be criminal. And that definition gets, you know, broader and broader every year, especially in this country where we have the largest system of surveillance and harassment and imprisonment in the history of humanity. And that is being, you know, that incredibly sophisticated and articulated system is now being directed against left protesters in a renewed escalation of repression.
Anya, what made you, if you look back on this, what made you want to do this? What made you want to be out there, you know? What is it that made you want to, you know, basically put yourself on the line in the way that you did?
And, I mean, you've just got to put your foot down sooner or later, you know? Trump becoming president shouldn't be people's final straw to get involved in activism, but I've seen that a lot lately. I think people need to, like, get more involved in their communities and start grassroots movements, and that's what I'm trying to do in my hometown. So I think it's important to just show that we won't take this. You know, we won't just allow a peaceful transition of power.
All right. Now, Sam, let's move on with you. Where are things at now, and where do you think they're going?
So, you know, as you mentioned earlier, the prosecution's decision to move forward on the existing charges against these 59 defendants is them basically doubling down on their initial approach and concentrating resources on trying to get convictions with a smaller number of people. It should be noted that their legal theory, that the prosecution's legal theory hasn't changed. The indictment hasn't been, you know, edited. None of the sort of fatal defects identified by numerous defense counsel have been addressed. And this is still very much trying to sort of forge new legal theories that would allow for sort of collective guilt and the sort of extreme criminalization of you know, acts of civil disobedience and resistance. I think that it's going to be really important that as the trials come up this year, folks are going to be tried in groups of like 5 to 6 between April 17th and October 29th is so far the latest scheduled trial, that we continue to show up and provide support for them, that we demonstrate that we as a community in Washington, D.C. and all over the United States and as the global left understand these charges to be politically motivated and totally illegitimate, that we'll provide material and emotional and political support to the defendants facing the state repression, and that we will be here no matter what happens through the disposition of their cases, no matter what the outcomes of the trials.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I want to go back to once again, because it really strikes me is like when you're looking at all of the things that people have been charged with, and you're looking at the whole way that this came down, it really did set. Even though there was the people were basically exonerated on this, but there was a thing set up that was going to be like, you know, no matter what, these things have been established, at least that they're basically, they've created a box that has all the things that they need around accusing people of doing various things and of making things like as simple as marching, as simple as being as Anya was talking about, she was a medic at the thing, being a medic. People who were medics were arrested and were accused of doing some kind of nefarious scheming to use their medical wherewithal to actually come up and do something nefarious in relation to all this. So I wanted to ask you this, where, you know, this is a huge thing. One way or the other, the system is really hammering into place, it seems, a fascist color to everything. I mean, that's even what they're doing in the courtroom. The fact that they did so many things in the courtroom that they were able to actually even put them out as acceptable pieces of the law and then, you know, move ahead with that. This is stuff that people should be paying attention to, that the system is unleashing actually and putting into place a fascist structure in the superstructure of society, in the courtrooms, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it was really remarkable to watch the two assistant U.S. attorneys, Jennifer Kirkhoff and Rizwan Qureshi, in the first trial, put forward some truly outrageous arguments and some truly vile characterizations of the marchers and the defendants, and have them greeted as if they were sort of reasonable pronouncements by the judge of the Superior Court, by, you know, some of the jurors, by you know, many of the people in the audience, and that they can sort of make these claims, and as long as they do so in a sort of, you know, legalistic manner, that folks won't sort of, you know, call it what it is, which is the rise of you know, fascism. And that we saw them unpack the medic kit that was full of things like Band-Aids, cough drops, sucrose tablets for people with low blood sugar, gauze, and say that meant that they were prepared for war. Really, like, tampons mean that people are prepared for war, that, you know, they seem to be escalating the sort of state's engagement with protesters and saying, yeah, we really are against you. We really do think of you as enemies of the state, and we will treat you as such. Watching that handled as if it is sort of business as usual in a court of law is terrifying.
In a court of law, and one that is actually, these are becoming actually the sort of the things that are being instituted throughout society in courtroom. And I think that, you know, this is the kind of scene that we're looking at. When you're talking about the rise of fascism, this is the kind of stuff that gets sort of rolled out, consolidated, and then bam, it's out there all the time. All right. So, Sam, anything you want to tell people about how they can keep up with you and what you're doing and the rest of this?
Yeah, I mean, so you can follow us on Twitter at DefendJ20. You can go to defendj20resistance.org for all of the latest updates. We have a bank of media articles. We have resources for folks who want to support. There's a way that you can donate to the fund to support defendants, both with sort of material support, getting them here and you know, helping to support the infrastructure we built to you know, provide a sort of network of resistance and solidarity. That they can go to dclegalposse.org if they want to learn about what's happening on the ground here in D.C., if they want to volunteer in D.C., if they can make it here, they can email info@dclegalposse.org. And, you know, there are still 59 people who could face decades in prison and really need our help.
All right, Sam Menifee Leiby, thank you once again for joining us on the show, man.
Yeah, thanks so much, Michael.
And we'll have you back again soon as things continue to develop. And Anya, thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, and we'll stay in touch with you and follow what happens to you along these lines in court, what's going on, all right?
Thanks. I appreciate the solidarity.
Okay. Take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Anya and Sam Menifee Leiby from the Dead City Legal Posse on the latest developments in the important fight to defend the Inauguration Day J20 protesters who were arrested and faced charges of being terrorists, basically, for standing up and fighting against the Trump fascist regime. Couldn't think of a better way to do things. All right, that's actually you want to get arrested for something. That's what you want to get arrested for. Something that's really worthwhile. All right, you know, there's been a lot. A lot of what happened now recently is the strengthening of fascism and all this. And I want to give people a chance to actually listen to something that we heard that Trump Pence, Bolton, the new, and it was in celebration of Bolton becoming the newest gangster in the crew. Trump, Bolton, Sessions, all of these, they were caught in the White House singing this song, and I wanted everybody to get a chance to hear it. Teddy, let's play that little piece over there, all right?
No one likes us, I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and they're hateful. They don't respect us, so let's surprise them. We'll drop the big one and pulverize them. Asia's crowded, Europe's too old, Africa's far too hot, and Canada's too cold, and South America stole our name. Let's drop the big one, there'll be no one left to blame us. We'll save Australia, don't wanna hurt no kangaroo. We'll build an all-American amusement park there, they got surfing too. Boom goes London, boom Paris.
All right, welcome back. That was the incredible Randy Newman just singing the truth. And you can just imagine those, all those pigs sitting up in the White House dancing to that one, all right? And I would love to see, you know, the three of them, Trump, Bolton, Pence, and who's the tiny guy? Yeah, that they were all like sort of tossing up in the air. yeah, Sessions. Anyway, once again, that was Randy Newman, and it was political science, right? Now, we're going to hear another excerpt from the Q&A that followed Bob Avakian's talk. And the talk is an incredibly important talk he gave a little while ago called "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the Name of Humanity, We Refuse to Accept the Fascist America, A Better World is Possible." And in this segment, it's basically Bob Avakian responds to the question, minorities have been in not a very favorable situation in this country to fight against everything that is going against them, because they're not in the land where they originally come from. How can we protect those who need to be on the streets fighting with us? How can we protect the ones that are being targeted directly? How can we get them to be on the streets? So without any further ado, let's listen to what Bob Avakian had to say on that one.
Since our minds are designed to stop us from doing anything that might hurt us, right? So minorities have been not in a very favorable situation in this country to fight for everything that, you know, that is going after them, not just Latinos, because they feel like they're not in the right place, they're not in the land where they originally come from, so they don't feel like they're in the position to fight for everything that is going after against them. So how can we protect those who need to be on the streets fighting with us? How can we protect the ones that are being targeted directly when they feel like they're not in a position to do that, because they will also be terrorized by saying, well, this is not your country, so how can we get them to be on the streets?
Okay, well, that's another important question. I mean, and it's a complicated, the situation is complicated. People, you know, as I was saying earlier, there are real consequences for people in standing up even against their own oppression. There are real consequences, you know, it can always get worse. And people, you know, for example, who are undocumented, are very vulnerable now, and I think there are different levels to this. One, all these different outrages are things that everybody has to be outraged about, not just the people who are most directly affected. This is an important thing we have to struggle with. When, you know, as I said, you know, this idea that, well, maybe I can avoid the horrors happening to me and my loved ones and those I most care about is deadly, you know, and will be the death of any real movement that we need. So there needs to be a struggle with everybody, you know, and people have to learn that, you know, this is a subject of struggle too, that, you know, just because you don't get, see, there's, you know, you don't get immediate results doesn't mean you should stop. Like, in this country, you know, in the recent decades, there have, oh, by the way, I wanted to say one other thing I forgot to say about your question of the media. Just let me just say this before I forget. Social media, that's very important too. Let's get all over social media and break through in that way. I just wanted to, in addition to all the other things about the media that were raised. But, you know, people have to be, you know, oriented that if something is important, you have to keep on struggling for it. You know, this is a land where we're conditioned for, you know, short attention spans and immediate gratification. You know, that's a problem that has to be struggled with. And what am I referring to? Well, the original travel ban came out from Trump. And, you know, there was a really good response where thousands of people went to airports and protested. That was really good. But then people get worn down. You know, Trump didn't say, oh, well, people protest, so I guess I shouldn't have a travel ban. You know, he's determined to have this travel ban. So he keeps reshaping it in different forms, and there's things go on in the courts, and he reshapes it. And now he's got another one, you know. Unfortunately, when he came out with a slightly, you know, altered version that didn't have everything bad that was in the first one, then there wasn't the same kind of outpouring that there was initially. Well, this is something that we have to break through on with people. That's the point about sustained resistance. So there were good sentiments, and there was a good outpouring of people who weren't directly involved. Overwhelmingly, people went to airports, were not Muslims or from the countries affected. The same thing has happened around DACA. The same thing has happened around deportations. People have protested, but it's not enough, you know, to protest once. This has to be sustained. You know, put it this way: if something was outrageous and you protest and it doesn't stop, it hasn't gotten less outrageous. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you have to, we have to win people that you have to keep, you have to keep moving around this. But that's where the point comes in about if you don't drive out the regime, as important as different fronts of resistance are, you're just fighting ultimately a losing battle on all these different fronts because they have maintained the initiative and this regime is still in power. So you have to sustain the resistance, but it has to be, you know, geared and directed toward what will deal, you know, with all of this, because there's a whole package of things. I spoke to it in the very beginning of my, you know, remarks. There's a whole package of things they're doing all at once, and it does feel overwhelming to people. But, you know, we have to win people, you know, to see the need to, you know, to both sustain resistance, but more than that, and, you know, crucially, to actually direct all of that toward driving out this regime, beginning with, you know, November 4th, and moving and sustaining. Now, to go back to the question more directly about people who are vulnerable, I think that there's a two-pronged answer, or an answer on two levels. One is what I've been talking about. Other people have to get involved, and other people have to take this. We're not directly affected in this or that thing, including deportations. Have to take the stand that this is intolerable and we won't allow it. You know, that's one thing that has to happen. As long as the regime's in power, you're not going to be able to win on that, you know. But you have to have that orientation. It's intolerable, and since it's intolerable, we're not just going to sit by and complain. We're actually going to, you know, have the stand that we're not going to allow it. The other thing is that the right tactics have to be developed so that people who are directly affected but have, you know, potentially high price to pay for getting involved can get involved. Because, you know, here's the problem, to put it really honestly. We cannot protect people from what the people in power are intending to do to them, other than by driving out the people in power. If that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be measures taken to protect people tactically in certain situations. You know, a lot of people are very creative. You see a lot of creativity whenever people are motivated about things. Sometimes really stupid things, but there's still a lot of creativity. sometimes really important things, you know, even things that get made fun of, you know, like when they had the Women's March the day after the inauguration, all the pussy hats and stuff. There's a lot of creative stuff, you know, that people do. So the creative means should be developed to do the best we can to protect people who are particularly vulnerable to attack. But on the other hand, there is no cheap and easy way to deal with what we're confronted with. And we have to be honest with people about that. We have to bring forward the massive thing that'll drive out this regime and create a much more favorable political situation in this country, or real horrors are going to come down on people all over the world, including environmental destruction. I mean, look, I sometimes feel like this. You, adjective, expletive, people who voted for Trump, okay, you know, you want to vote for Trump. According to the rules of the system, you have a right to vote for, you know, whomever you want. You don't have a f***ing right to drag all of humanity down to oblivion. Yeah. You know, and this is what we're dealing with here. And so there, you know, this is what we're confronted with. And there, you know, we have to do our best to protect each other, and not just in a narrow little small group way, but in thinking in terms of thousands and millions. But, you know, I'm just going to tell the truth. This fight will not be won without sacrifice. You know, it would be great if it could be, but it can't be. And if we tell people a lie, we're just going to set them up for even worse things. We're going to have to sacrifice. I mean, you know, some of you may be familiar with the statement by this pastor Niemöller, who lived during the time of Hitler in Germany in the 1930s and 40s. And he, you know, he himself was persecuted, but he made this statement he made two statements. One of them people are more familiar with. He said, "First they came for the communists, but I wasn't a communist, so I said nothing. Then they came for the Jews, but I wasn't a Jew, so I said nothing. Then they came for the trade unionists, but I wasn't a trade unionist, so I said nothing. Then they came for me, and there was nobody there to stand up with me." But he also said, and look, I'm not saying these are the terms that we're confronting now, but he also said, if all of us who hated this had stood up at the beginning, maybe many of us, even thousands, would have had to die, but at least we would have prevented the horrors that were brought forth. Now, I'm not saying here, look, people's lives are precious. I'm not saying that, you know, sacrifice is an easy thing or talking about it lightly or anything like that. But if we recognize what we're dealing with, we also have to recognize that it's not going to be achieved without sacrifice. We should never give, you know, the people who are responsible for all these horrors any cheap victories. We should never allow them to have any cheap taking of people's lives or their freedom or anything like that. People are precious. People's freedom is precious, and we should understand and act accordingly. But we also have to recognize that, and this applies for all of us, we're going to have to sacrifice to deal with what we're dealing with. And that's just the plain truth. And people have to understand that. And people are capable of great heroism, again, when they understand two things. When they understand why it's necessary, and when they feel that they are not acting all on their own and in isolation, but together with many other people who recognize and are standing up for the same thing.
All right, that's an excerpt from a speech that was given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, at the end of last year, sometime around the end of last year. And it's an extremely important piece, and I would really recommend that people go to this, because it's something in the world we're living in today. This is something that actually pulls no punches and actually talks about and lays out a way that we can come together and get out of this and move on to a whole better world. But this is something that's really important in terms of people that are looking for a way to stand up against the rise of fascism and what that means for the world, all right? All right, we are going to jump into now our next segment, and this is something I was able to talk with this man, and it's I think it's a really important piece, so check this out. When you talk about U.S. college campuses today, you have to talk about people being placed on watch lists, people harassed on social media, threatened. This is becoming normal in an environment increasingly hostile to faculty. Over the last year, targeted online harassment of faculty has emerged as a significant threat to academic freedom. David Palumbo Liu is a professor of comparative literature at Stanford University and has been targeted by the fascist paper Stanford Review, called a terrorist for being a member of the campus anti-fascist network and set up for a campaign of online harassment. David Palumbo Liu joins us to talk about all this today. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Sure. Now, David, in the piece that I read from you, your most recent piece, I guess it came out in early February, and you said that you are used to receiving abusive messages and being publicly maligned. Now, however, attacks on me have reached troubling new heights, and you wrote back in February that you are a Stanford professor accused of being a terrorist. McCarthyism's back. What are you talking about here, man?
Okay, so, you know, I've done a lot of work, especially on issues of Israel, Palestine, and I've been quite active and very public about my activities, and because of them, I've gotten both a lot of compliments and a lot of hate mail and things like that. And so you just take that as part of the commitment. But recently, a conservative campus newspaper at Stanford wanted to do a story on a network that I helped set up called the Campus Anti-Fascist Network. And we really were motivated by the intensified attacks on campuses by the alt-right and the failure of most campus administrations to really respond in any intelligent way. So we began that network, and it's grown tremendously, and we've been heartened by its success. And so this reporter wanted to know how we stood on violence, and I told her exactly how we stand on it, which is that we are not proactively going out and damaging property or attacking people, but we do feel that physical violence should be met with self-defense, and that we were all for that. And she pressed me, and I responded with a more elaborate, same kind of answer. And this is all on email, because I like to do that with journalists. And the exchange seemed quite cordial and professional, and then she sent me the link to the article when it came out, and the headline was, "Anti-Fa Thugs Find Leader in Stanford Professor." So something went dramatically wrong. And so I looked at the article, and it basically talked past all of my answers. Antifa is known for being violent and destructive. And if they use the name anti-fascist, it must mean they endorse violence. And there's no doubt that he's the leader of a terrorist organization. And you know, I felt that was pretty bad, but as long as it was on the campus, it was one thing. But this journal is called the Stanford Review, and it's like the Dartmouth Review. It was started in the late 80s. This particular version of the review at Stanford was started by Peter Thiel, and he's continued to be a supporter of their journalism. And they got it up into a larger set of media, including Fox News, and Fox News did a print article on it. And then about a week later, they were on Fox and Friends repeating exactly all these things that they had said that had no basis in reality. And as I said at the beginning of our conversation, I'm used to taking hits for things I say or do, but I said nothing and I've done nothing that vaguely resembles what they accused me of doing, to the degree that when this started to really circulate around Stanford, six constitutional law experts at the Stanford Law School from both the right and left wrote an article saying, as much as we may or may not agree with David Palumbo Liu, he's done nothing that at all resembles the Stanford Review has said, and he's well within his free speech rights. Mm-hmm. So the point of the Guardian article that I wrote is to say that these days, we know that historically McCarthyism was all about sending out false and misleading information to smear people irresponsibly, but in these days of the internet, this has taken on new kind of danger that I think people should know about.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that I want to just let people in on is that the attacks on you have also included death threats. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the standard, the hate mail, the messages on my answering machine, hard mail copies coming in from all over the place. And you know, interestingly, the Stanford Security Department did trace them, and most of the letters were coming from two states, Oklahoma and Arizona. So it's not surprising, but it just shows how these things can spread into all sorts of different pockets.
Now, One of the things also that I thought is really important for people to know is that when you were talking about the character of the Stanford Review, you talked about actually their character in general, but they also, and the fact that they went out to Fox News and Fox and Friends, but there was also a whole collection of really pretty scurvy, reactionary, fascistic groups that they also took this attack on you up.
Yeah, Campus Reform, Jihad Watch, you name it. They all feed off the same kind of news stories, and they just amplify the message, and it gets out to more and more readers, and then that takes on its own life.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, too, I wanted to ask you about is you say that this attack on you is part of a broader phenomenon in terms of what's developing on college campuses, that there's an actual battleground developing. Let's talk about that. I think it's important to dig into that a little.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there are actually three tiers of attack, and the first is on professors who are seen as dangerous, espousing views that go contrary to some that are more commonly supported by the mainstream educational structure. And so they go after people like myself and George Cicerario Mara and Johnny Eric Williams and Kianga Yamata Taylor. And, all those folks that have been voicing progressive/radical views, and they take quotes out of context, they distort what was said, they do smear jobs, and that's meant to intimidate not only the individuals involved, but also any other professor is basically been warned not to say anything like that. In my case, of course, in this instance, I said nothing, so it even has amped the ante, so to speak. The second layer is students, and this is really important for your listeners to know, because all campuses have a certain number of students who are progressive and who want to take part in their educational life in an active way rather than in a passive way. And a lot of these progressive students are students of color and trans and queer people and people that have been, in a sense, recruited to universities because of their diversity and because universities like to espouse their broad liberal palette of education. And yet, when students come to campus and they start voicing any opinions that are so diverse as to actually possibly make a difference in somebody's worldview, then they get clamped down on pretty hard. They're taught that they're speaking out of place, or they're being aggressive, or they're shutting people down, any number of things. And so when professors get hit, often students are hit by the same machines. In fact, when Robert Spencer came to Stanford, it was students in my class, as a matter of fact, who wrote letters of protest that then got doxxed by Robert Spencer's Jihad Watch. When the right talks about the deprivation of freedom of speech on their side, I want people to understand that even if you don't act, what happens in this current situation is that people's freedom of speech is preemptively taken away because nobody dares to speak out. The third tier is administrators who, with the exception of very, very few administrators, they are playing a game that really is reaching back to the 60s or the 70s and the days of protest then and saying, well, we should use the same formulaic speeches about freedom of speech and diversity of opinion and all of that. But they refuse to see the current situation, which is patently different in so many different ways. To begin with, the attacks are not coming from miscellaneous individuals or small groups here and there. It's a well-funded set of groups like Turning Point USA that's funded by Charlie Kirk. Mercer, who we've seen recently in Cambridge Analytica, has been active. The Koch brothers, of course. So this is a well-funded set of campaigns that, as I said before, were probably conceived of by the older reactionaries in the late 80s when the culture wars came out and the whole notion of diversity and multiculturalism began to take hold. The right got very upset about this, and they've been planning and they've been organizing. Now they have a very well-organized, well-funded set of apparatuses, and they're facilitated by the fact that we have the president we have right now who's tearing down the Justice Department and shredding the Constitution. So administrators just refuse to see the historical context in which we're living in and prefer to live in this bureaucratic, neutral space that's beyond time somehow. And that's been one of the Campus Anti-Fascist Network's primary goals, is to sit down with administrators and really try to get them to understand there's a really different kind of threat to the university, and that if they are sanguine about professors or even some students getting harmed by it, it won't be too long before administrators are also targets.
Mm-hmm. Now, David, one of the things that you talk about, which I thought was very important, is in the beginning of the pieces that you've written, you've talked about McCarthyism. And in other pieces that you've written with other professors, you've talked about McCarthyism. And you said all kinds of people, including scientists and other professors, are being hit. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I'm really glad you made that point, because what we've been talking about so far has been political activism. But if you go to the website of, it's called the American Association of University Professors, you'll find all this data on scientists, people that you think are of as being objective, apolitical, just doing their work, you know, in very contained laboratory situations. And some people that have been getting the worst death threats are people that have been talking about climate change, for example, or talking about any number of environmental or ecological issues that deal with science. And of course, you know, Trump hates science, and scientists are now part of this endangered group of professors. And so when you have the combination of McCarthyism, which, again, has only a distant relationship with the truth, the megaphone that the Internet has provided, well-organized political campaigns, and a real taste for disinformation and distortion of facts, this is a dangerous situation across the board, across disciplines.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Professor David Palumbo Liu. David is a professor at Stanford University, and he's recently come under attack at Stanford for daring to stand up against fascists. And those attacks have been coming from fascist magazine writers themselves at Stanford University. Now, tell me this. Do you think that all of this is related to an overall attempt by the Trump regime overall in society to criminalize all opposition?
I don't think that it's a matter of criminalizing. I think it's a matter of a kind of this gets back to the Cambridge Analytica. It's a kind of psychological warfare. It's instilling people kind of internal self-censoring mechanisms. So you just don't think about things, or you don't speak. And so I don't even think they worry about criminalizing. I think they just want to strike fear into people. And the real damage this does is that it makes it very hard to take a stance without feeling that you might be reported by somebody who's had pressure. I mean, Turning Point USA is a good example. They will come onto campuses with like capitalism rules, or, you know, I love the free market, Marxism sucks. I mean, these things are, they don't seem to, you know, merit much attention. But once they get on campus, they start recruiting people, and all of a sudden, students are taping lectures on their iPhones and sending it to the organization's center. And then they've actually started to do things like fund reactionary candidates for student government. And the other thing that has been starting to be reported is they're now moving into high school. So it's really more of a brainwashing type of operation than a criminalization. And in that sense, it's even more pernicious, because with criminalization, you can hire a lawyer, you can go back on whatever rights we have. But when you're striking fear at this level and you're intimidating and silencing people that present alternate possibilities for seeing the world in different ways, that's really dangerous.
Now, you've also talked about, and I thought this was actually pretty interesting and important for people to understand, you talked about how you're troubled by various liberals not stepping up to defend all the people that are under attack these days, instead accepting and popularizing a breakdown of anti-Trump forces as good and bad protesters.
Exactly. That's another thing that is very disappointing, and it's happening more and more and more. You know that when Charles Murray spoke at Middlebury, the press went to town with the students and the faculty being violent, being physical, but nobody reports the main cause, which was that a conservative student group brought him on campus. Many students and many faculty protested peacefully, and then the college president accepted the invitation to introduce Charles Murray. And that's what really crossed the line, because as long as his appearance was under the auspices of the conservative group, that was relatively contained. But when you have the president of the college introducing him, it's like giving a kind of benediction to the whole event. And students and faculty pled with her not to do that, because that was not her job to endorse a political position, which is what she was doing, and particularly an ideological position that was very, very dismissive of, to say the least, a whole swath of students. That's what intensified the protest. And what happened after that was that, according to people that I know at Middlebury, the people that were least supportive were basically old white male liberals who felt that they had paid the dues way back in the 70s or something, and their political progressive credentials were still burnished and everything was fine. But they have no sense of the, again, of the contemporary world. And when you know that people like Peter Thiel and the Koch brothers and Mercer and others are funding things, I mean, they've made it very clear what they're about. But when you, especially as a teacher, when I talk to my students, they say, well, you know, the administration said this or that, and they've encouraged us to do this or that. And then when the students are actually hung out to dry, that's really discouraging. And I'd rather have enemies I know than friends that are false. I actually had one professor at Stanford. There was an open letter that was circulated to support me, and one professor who had tenure. There are three tiers of a professorship. One is assistant, where you don't have tenure. Associate, you have tenure, and then full, I mean, you hit the top. And he said, I would sign the letter, but I'm only an associate professor. that really speaks volumes in terms of how self-protective some folks are. And so liberals are particularly destructive when they speak one thing and then act a totally different way.
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting in a piece that you co-wrote with a few other people. You talked about Chris Hedges, and I can't remember who the other person was. But in general, you were talking about people who are seen by as sort of progressive liberals who will come out and fight for what's right, turn around and then put limits on what people are supposed to do in responding to fascists.
Exactly. And the disappointing is that some of these folks are smart people, and some of them have done really good investigative work, but they let their investigative skills go the pot when it comes to really looking at, probing at these depictions of supposed anti-fa violence, because so much of it is caught out of the frame, and so much of it was provoked by the right, and so much of it was precisely what Cornel West describes at Charlottesville. As he said, they would have been crushed like cockroaches if Antifa hadn't stepped in between them and people that were wielding weapons. And these are clergy people, you know? So I'm really disappointed at the fact that so many people that could take 5 more minutes and look at other news sources to see what's going on, instead vilify anti-fascist work and paint it all with the same brush.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think some of it, too, though, I think it's important because some of it is actually looking at the storm that's coming in. It's got those heavy clouds. Yeah. It's like really pushing and pushing. And people sort of being hit by it. They're kind of fearful of it. They're worried about how am we going to survive? How am I going to survive? And not seeing that actually in a situation like this, you are called on to do a lot more than just survive yourself, you know?
Exactly. I mean, you saw the news today that Bolton has been named National Security Advisor.
Yeah.
I mean, that's insane. I mean, it's not unexpected for Donald Trump, but by any standard, it's so belligerent and stupid and dangerous. But not everybody, but people of my generation, a lot of people are saying, well, it'll blow over, it'll pass. And people that say that are the most protected people there are. Right? I mean, they will weather the storm that you've been talking about. When people say, oh, well, let's let Trump get elected, it'll trigger a revolution. They're not looking at the first people on the line that are going to get damaged or not the affluent, the white, the middle class. It's going to be precisely the undocumented, the people that are the most precarious in society. They're going to be the ones that are permanently damaged. And I don't think any of us can afford to say, well, until it gets into my neighborhood, it's not a serious problem.
Mm-hmm. David, you've made an important political point various times that fascism in the U.S. has never been so evident and has never enjoyed such freedom to act as it will, unencumbered by the rule of law or by conventional politics. Let's talk about that and what that requires from people on the campuses today and throughout society at large. You talked about the need for a big tent, too, which I thought was really important.
Yeah, I think that the main thing is to wake up. that this is unprecedented, and it requires more than simply checking in to see the latest Trump tweet. You really have to understand that this is a tightly knit structure. It's not just one individual. It's a perfect storm for fascism. It's a demoralized political body. It's young people who came out for what they thought was a progressive candidate only to see him being, you know, buried by a centrist machine. It's the deportation of human beings, right and left, regardless of their circumstances or what they may or may not have done. And it's, as you know, I'm most obviously centered in the university. It's really striking at the last bastion where people can actually think and talk and disagree with each other and have different analytics on what's going on and then move forward in ways that will benefit all and not just some. So the most important thing people can do is just be patient and listen to multiple sources and try to figure out what's going on rather than, and it's really hard, especially as an activist, because we're bombarded with crises every other second. And you think, you know, it's like plugging up the holes in all sorts of breaks in the dam at once. But we have to see the underlying structures that are driving all of this and really keep our eye on that. The other thing we have to do is really lean on each other. I mean, one of the most heartening experiences I had was I went to San Francisco Airport after the travel ban was announced. And, you know, there are tons of people out there. And it was almost intuitively that people would create these shifts. I mean, some people would leave, but other people would fill in the gap. And I think that's something we all need to do, too. We can't expect all of us to be active 24/7. We have to spell each other. We have to lean on each other, which also means that for this to work, everybody has to step up.
Let me ask you this,
everybody
David.
Can step up in different manners as they are able to. Not everybody can do it in exactly the same way, but there are all sorts of different scales of involvement.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to ask you this because, you know, one of the things that really attracted me to what you've been saying is that there is a need for this kind of movement. And I wanted to ask you again this thing of, I don't think we can actually leave out the importance of what you've been arguing about throughout most of this talk, is that, look, people do have to stand up and fight against this. You know, we've seen way too many things. You know, talk about Germany, talk about Poland, talk about, you know, all these places, Italy. Whenever fascism has been on the rise, if people have not stood up to oppose this, it's been nothing but horrifying slaughter of the people.
Right. And I would recommend to you and your listeners, the guy's name is Bernard Knox, K-N-O-X. I think it's called Premature Anti-Fascism. There's a wonderful essay by this person who was there with the Lincoln Brigade and all that. He says exactly the same thing. They were smeared the label Premature Anti-Fascist. And he said, it's like being prematurely anti-poison. You know, what kind of, you know, what maturity do you have to wait for before you can step out and take a position? And it's usually when it's too late.
Mm-hmm. All right. I want to thank you very much, David.
Thank you. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye. All right, that was David Palumbo Liu, professor of comparative literature at Stanford University, and we've been talking about how he and dozens of other professors have been targeted by fascists. In his case, he was slandered by a fascist newspaper, the Stanford Review, called a terrorist for being a member of the campus anti-fascist network and, like many others, set up for a campaign of online harassment. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all those appearing on the show today, Sam Menefee-Leiby, Anya Babavakian, and David Palumbo Liu. You will find all the addresses for the websites mentioned on today's show on my Facebook page. And I'd like to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we're going to go out now with Not in Our Name from Savage Rose. Talk to you again next week.